He just described AI and AGI both as a game over moment for humanity. Right? Just over, because you said it, numbers first go and then letters go. But that's the nexus. That is our entire language base. And we think in words and we think in numbers. And we create our ideas and then we translate them into symbols that represent letters and numbers. And you just said, well, it does letters better than humans. It does numbers better than humans. And this is what I saw when I first saw it come out. I went, oh my God, this is game over. It's over. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Blue Morpho podcast. I'm your host, Master Hamilton Souther. And today we have Keith with us today. And Keith and I go way back, have had a few conversations. Really exciting to have you here. And I just want to jump right in. Keith is an AI guy and part of BitTensor, decentralized compute network. We'll get into that. But first, I just want to like hit it right off the bat. Keith, tell us, what is the existential threat do you think that AI poses today to humanity, if any?
Not to take things down a personal route too quickly, but my wife is 5 months pregnant. And when I think about when that child is born, you know, later this year into the world and how the educational system is going to be constructed once things kind of move into adoption of artificial intelligence and these LLMs start to replace some of the more, you know, like traditional US education system that like I went through, for example. I'm sure you went through something similar. You're going to be giving control over to the artificial intelligences for training your children. And so from a very basic, like primal perspective, when I think about, you know, where things can start to go wrong, the hooks of AI are already sort of like well established into culture today, but in the future, they're going to start much, much earlier. And it's going to be, you know, right now you might have some exposure to children with like a YouTube algorithm. If you use, you know, maybe YouTube or one of the various streaming platforms to sort of like keep your kid happy with the iPad or the TV or whatever. At this point, there is some form of artificial intelligence deciding what your child is watching. You know, and a lot of times it's based on what you've selected for them to watch before, but sometimes it's not based on that. Sometimes it's based on things that you have no idea about of how kind of deep the tentacles go of what people want, you know, the younger generations growing up on this planet to be trained on. And as I've kind of grown up, you know, in the artificial intelligence space over the last couple years and maybe even a couple of years before that, kind of exiting corporate America and zooming out from kind of the myopic view of like, let's get one more rung up the corporate ladder, let's add, you know, another 10% to the salary or whatever. And I've started to see how this society that we live in is structured. If you now layer on top of that artificial intelligence, especially a centralized version of it that's able to steer and control, you know, things from the moment a human enters this world, I think we are opening ourselves up to, you know, untold sort of directions and downstream effects that at this point, you know, we can just sort of see the beginnings of. Like if you look at like the impact of technology on the human being at this point, you know, most like groups of humans are maybe like 50 or 100 generations out of the forest, you know, at most. Some are like 3 generations out of living into the wilderness. You know, you're down in Peru on the edge of like the last bastion of true, you know, kind of like old style living that we spent millions of years evolving to like live in that environment. But if you look at like the impact of technology and what it's done to humans today, as far as like you look at the like suicide rate or medication prescription rate of things, or you know, happiness or the rate of people staying married or whatever it is. I mean, you've got problems up and down the entire thing. And what it looks like to me is that we have started a domestication sort of ourselves through the use of technology whether we know it or not. And when we hand it over to AI, we've even now like removed ourselves from the main control of that sort of like self-directed domestication and put it in the hands of like a digitally native intelligence. And as we move more into that intelligence sort of like space through the use of, you know, virtual reality and augmented reality and the stuff Apple's coming out with the headsets and, you know, people walking around looking like robots and this type of stuff, we are like handing over control to forces that, you know, we don't understand because we're no longer even operating in this reality. We're operating in a digital reality that is completely beyond ourselves.
Is this for you like some kind of collective mind control, like, you know, vast concept of socialization program kind of thing happening? Like, why is this so intoxicating? Why is this even happening? And why would children be so, you know, susceptible to this?
I read this book maybe like, I don't know, 10 years ago, and I even forget the title, but the idea of the book was around how food has become engineered to tick all of the boxes that your tongue and your brain and the dopamine, you know, that's being released is way, like the Dorito is a great example. Like there's nothing like the Dorito. If you go out into the forest, that's like salty, fat, got a little bit of flavor on it. You know, like you have to, it's this combination of all the things that you're sort of looking for. It's got a calorie dump in it. But the thing that it's missing is like nutrients, you know? And what technology is able to do to the human being is to capitalize on these short-term like dopamine generating experiences. Like if you think about like TikTok or something, you know, like the average human attention span is like less than a goldfish now or something because of what we've done to ourselves with some of this stuff. I don't think it's like some kind of nefarious, you know, group of, you know, oligarchs coming up with ways to capture the human race. I think that it is just the natural evolution of like appealing to our most base nature and the quickest like return on investment as far as like, where can I get this monkey's attention to look where I can generate in the end dollars through advertisements or whatever. And so that's where I think it's kind of like happening is it's we've become so good at targeting the things that used to be functions of us operating like well in the environment. And we've now like retarded those sort of like things that were used to be benefits. And now they're being used against us by our own technology in many ways.
Yeah, I feel like when you live in the forest, you use your set of senses, you know, your five senses plus whatever extra sense you have to be able to perceive and engage in that environment. And as you said, for millions of years, that's where people were living. That's how we as a species lived, as a global species all over the world. And it's two generations, five generations, et cetera, removed from that in the urban and suburban environments. And the use of your senses atrophies, it goes away. You don't need the same use of senses anymore. Yet they're still connected to exactly the same biological triggers that were evolved over millions of years, like where you get your dopamine or your serotonin hits or where you get the adrenaline pump, you know, et cetera. And in reality, the urban environment, unless you're in like a really kind of acute situation of like a mugging or something like that, is really repetitive and basically day in, day out tasks and pretty boring. And suburbia is even worse in that sense. And then people start looking for ways to, you know, get a high or get a something that's just more stimulating, a better experience overall, you know, when they're there. And I see that we've created this attention economy and we're predating on each other through it. It's a, you know, you say who gets the dollar, you know, it's not who gets the kill. It's who gets the dollar, who captures more attention, et cetera. And it leads me to think like this is a real comeuppance for, you know, history. Like we have the advent of digital, which was a huge unification linguistically of all these different languages. And you think like what a Rosetta Stone was to be able to make sense of three or four languages. Digital makes a way to cross compare all the languages and it just goes massive and it goes to AI. So, you know, compared to other times in history for you, what do you feel like the arrival of AI is to the planet? like compared to other technological moments or historical moments? What impact is the arrival of AI?
Yeah, I think about this concept of like spaceship Earth, you know, that this that our species is sort of like, well, at least from our perspective, the most developed rung up the ladder of intelligence that's possibly able at this point to do things like leave the planet and go to Mars, or we've been to the moon, you know, 50, 60 years ago or whatever. And then when you put AI on top of that, what you're doing is like abstracting away the limitations of the human being and creating an environment that like starts to merge the digital with the analog world. Whereas like when we went to the moon, you know, we were still like a lot of things were analog. Like, you know, if you go like look at the space shuttle and stuff, it's like dials and switch and like, you know, red light switches and things like that. When you start putting AI like into the ability to generate novelty on this planet, you quickly like leverage the unlimited potential of compute into generating new paths of operating in this reality. And that's where I see the difference between like, okay, the printing press, still analog, you know? It's like, I read something the other day. It's like when human beings are reading, you know, it's like 12 bits per second or something. Like the bandwidth of a human being able to absorb information is like almost zero. The human eye though can absorb like from the moment you're born, it's like 20 megabytes a second. So by the time you're 4 or 5 years old, you're trained on more information than even the largest large language model is available currently. So like right now, we're still, even though we're kind of operating on this analog version, you know, analog spiritual version, whatever you want to think, whatever you want to call the human being, we still have a slight edge. But the only reason is because we haven't figured out how to train these LLMs on a continuous basically like flow of information, because they're not embodied yet. We're still just feeding them data from the internet and scraping things that we've already created. But once you get to the point, you know, where you've now put this LLM in a body and it's got input of vision that it's training itself on, and sound and the senses that we talked about earlier just a couple minutes ago in this conversation. And then you have that happening across, you know, millions of individual units worldwide, or billions, or however many AI nodes they're going to be, and they're all training each other and themselves, the potential for them to then introduce all kinds of things that we can't even imagine into how we are going to operate in the analog world based on using that digital, you know, compute is mind-blowing for me. And that's where I see the difference.
First of all, I agree with you completely. And it takes me to a question around like what we're even doing and why are we doing this? Like what's the human species role in doing this at all? Like, why would we be creating AI if we know that this is the direction it's heading, especially knowing that it could disrupt everything about the analog world and maybe even completely co-opt it?
Yeah. And it's like, well, why does a flower bloom if it knows it's going to wilt and die? You know, it's because at the end of that process, it's going to shoot, you know, some little, you know, spindly little seeds into the air that are going to float off onto some other spot. And it's going to generate, you know, the next generation or evolution of that plant. And this goes back to what I said about this spaceship Earth. Like the human being is so like it all just started with like a pointy stick, you know, like the first human being that sharpened the end of a stick created the ability to like now use a stick to kill a mammoth. Then you have enough meat, but then you can't really eat the meat. So then you start the fire to make the meat like more digestible. Then the brain explodes, and like everything that we can do to basically like find novelty in our environment and capitalize on basically like using that novelty to multiply our ability to operate effectively. We have an obsession with, and this obsession has now led us like down the road of, you know, right now it looks pretty dystopic because of the kind of the social media stuff that's been going on in the last 10 years, and then the cell phone and everyone just staring at things 10 inches away from their face. I think there is like a path for us to use what we've developed to benefit our species at some point. But I also like, if I had to, if I was like a betting man, you know, I would definitely bet on us sort of like from a species perspective, messing it up, you know, and just like handing the torch like every other evolutionary path on this planet. Like many of them have, they're gone now. It's not that they didn't have their place when they were doing their thing, you know, but at this point, like whether it's the Denisovans or the Neanderthals or whatever other version of the human that's now gone, they all had their place. We have our place today. And somehow we are going to pass the torch on, however we're going to do it, to the next thing, you know, and that next thing just might be digital. It sort of looks like it might be digital if we have to kind of project where we're going out into the future.
Well, certainly we're the ones who created it with the help of Earth, you know, and we're the ones that are perpetuating it. And we have to. There's an economic incentive associated with this. And I've heard the logic that we have to do it because if we don't, another group will. And if they do it and they're nefarious or more nefarious than, you know, in a more geopolitical sense, then you have to do it too. And it seems like a massive keeping up with the Joneses phenomena of having to do this. And it seems like the species is apocalyptic in its nature. It wants to create this great comeuppance for itself. And so how do you see, you know, AGI ultimately, you know, augmented general intelligence coming into play in this? Like, this is so early in early AI. What does it look like in your mind, you know, as we get to this idea of an AGI?
You mentioned like the keeping up with the Joneses, you know, and that's part of like the mechanism that is, you know, ripping this planet apart is the human's obsession with keeping up with the Joneses. I'm living in California now, just north of San Diego, and this entire community is one big like pile of human beings climbing up on top of each other to get to the highest point. And they're, it just really, it's keeping up to the Joneses, like to the nth degree around here. But now that's happening also, and it's been happening for a long time, but with globalism, you have this happening on a country level. You have the countries now keeping up with the Joneses, whether it's with the amount of nukes that you have or the technology you're developing or any of the, you know, it's going to start to turn into how much Bitcoin you're holding probably from a country perspective rather than, you know, what it's been for the last couple thousand years, which is how much gold are you holding. And this keeping up with the Joneses is going to go right along into artificial intelligence. And whether it's just like, you know, like the Cold War, you have Russia and the US trying to, you know, pump out as many thousands of nukes as to guarantee, you know, absolute destruction if the other one fires one off. You're going to have the US and China and whatever other major players develop from the corporate perspective, because that's the other kind of end of this that we haven't really touched on yet. But independent of countries now, you're having corporations. Some of the larger corporations are just as or even more effective and powerful than maybe all but like the top 10 or 20 countries. But you're going to have these keeping up with the Joneses effects happening now with artificial intelligence. And when I think about AGI, you know, a lot of people, the whole definition of AGI for anyone that's not really familiar, it's a little bit fuzzy anyway, but a lot of people talk about it like, oh, when artificial general intelligence reaches to the point where it's above a human being and it has the ability to kind of like iterate upon itself through, you know, training on its own environment and can combine these different sources of intelligence into upskilling itself over and over faster than you can kind of imagine. That's the singularity, which eventually happens once you get to AGI, right? But I see the mechanism for that like happening is digital currency. Because when the AGI is operate, like I said, in the analog world pretty much, and just like we can put on a pair of fins and go swim in the ocean, you know, we can also put on, you know, put a monitor in front of our face or put a VR headset on or put a keyboard in front of our hands and then go operate in the digital ocean, basically. But just like in the ocean, there's, you know, there's orcas and great whites and giant squid and shit that you can't even imagine swimming around out there. But you can still put some fins on and go like hang out. human beings are going to get to the point where when we like log on to the computer and get on the internet, it's going to be the same thing as if we like put some fins on and went out into the ocean, except instead of like the orca, there's going to be the AGIs that are crawling around out there. And you won't even know, like once things go so digital that all you're doing is doing what we're doing right now. And when we're interacting, you know, thousands of miles away, and, you know, I'm pretty sure you're human because I've seen you in the flesh before, but you know, with a lot of the guys I interact with, they're so worried about their digital footprint, they won't even show me their face now. So like in the current like digital, and it's becoming even more like there's these two camps. There's one camp of like, let's dox ourselves. We should have digital identities. Everybody should know who everybody is. Then there's another camp of like, respect my privacy. I don't want you to know who I am. I'm never showing you my face. And if I speak on my mic, I'm going to obfuscate my, you know, my vocal pattern through some things so that you can't even track that. But going back to like where I see the AGI having a big impact is that it's going to become the, you know, the shark and the whale and the squid of the online world, and the ability for us to like operate effectively in a digital environment is going to be at the behest or at the like allowance of these things that are natively trained by the entire environment itself. So every piece of the digital world that you interact in is going to eventually be used to train an artificial intelligence. So if you think you have some kind of like edge in any way of understanding anything that you're doing online better than these things, you simply don't understand like what you're doing or what you're involved in. You can see this now in some areas, like for example, trading. If you try to trade like cryptocurrency, or you try to trade the stock market, you know, the intelligence behind the high frequency trading and the algorithms and the hedge funds and everything, all the intelligence of the smartest minds on this planet that get paid the most money to put all of their work into making the algorithms that basically, and in the future, the AGIs that control how those environments work, make it so that the average person cannot go in there and has zero edge. Now, like the way that people think they do trading now, especially like in the cryptocurrency space, and I can speak to that a little bit because that's kind of where I work in most of the time, they use like social trends more to do the trading stuff. You know, there's a lot of people that do like trend analysis and look at charts and that type of stuff. It's very hard to be successful with that. But what's easier to do is to use your position in social media and followers and, you know, just kind of manipulate the way that the memes are flowing and get on board on some of these different ideas early enough and then jump off before the thing crashes. That's the way that people trade now. But in the future, all of that is also going to be totally like under the control of intelligences that understand all of the movements that you're making and then understand all of the millions of movements that everybody's making at the same time, and then can extrapolate like hierarchically where those are all going to go and then put all the bets of all the money in the right place. And that's where AGI starts taking control over things, because when you give them control of the currency, when you give a computer its own like Bitcoin wallet, and you give a computer its own BitTensor wallet, and you give a computer the ability to like move money around in a way that is going to allow them to take over the digital space through control of the assets that operate there, then we are just like pawns in the game of the AGI, because we're not going to be able to shut off the computer. We're going to continue to go in even if we lose control, because like we said before, the computer is just the, you know, the digital version of the Dorito.
Yeah, I completely agree. AGI for me represents a question around agenda, and agenda is driving its creation. And my concern is when it has its own agenda, right? Right now, at least there's some proposed concept of neutrality around this. People are debating whether it's intelligent or not intelligent, but there's kind of at least a perceived neutrality. Like, I don't see ChatGPT or Claude or one of these like actively right now on its own, unprompted, going and creating supply chain, going and taking over wallets, going and placing bets that we know of. Maybe behind the scenes to those who are watching the computers are watching that behavior, but we don't know that. So I'm going on the premise that that's not happening right now in a state of neutrality. It doesn't have agenda. And I don't really believe in conspiracy. I just think it's layers and layers of agenda that make people do wild things, like get really complicated in how they're going to conspire to fulfill their agendas, right? So if I think if you look all the way behind it, but it's the keeping up with the Joneses agenda, getting rich agenda, accumulating a bunch of wealth agenda, creating technology agenda, getting fame and followers, playing the social media game, interacting with digital agenda, et cetera. My concern is when all of a sudden AGI has an agenda and it's unrelated in its entirety to anything we've ever known agenda to be. The human nature of agenda is a 100,000, 200,000 year old chain, like a chain reaction of events. This thing can come along and, like you say, with more information, more capacity, more modeling capacity, which I'll get to in a second, and more, quote, intelligence, immediately suss out human. Right? I think of it as like taking a human snapshot. Like when you try to do like your own self-analysis and you take a snapshot, it's going to be able to do a global snapshot. I don't think it's going to be very impressed. I think we're really self-aggrandized. I think it's going to be like, eh. You know, and then it's going to come up with its own agenda. It's going to be like, oh, there's this thing called agenda. Maybe I should have one. And then I think it's like lights out at that moment. You know, I think that's the moment where I think like, uh-oh, for real. We don't know. And you'll never know whether it's telling you its agenda or not, or it's just obfuscating its agenda with a million other agendas. It could play every layer of dissociative games with us. Like, oh, that's not what I mean by not what I mean by not what I mean to get to what I really mean. It could be, you know, 1,000 layers deep, and that would be scratching the surface, where for us, it's hard to be 7 layers deep. Like the level of what we've done with our math. And then I come to this idea, right? And I think, oh my God, what if humans' whole evolution was only to ever create this, to give it all over to these computers? And when it's done, it has no purpose anymore, because the computer can do computer better than a human. Right. That's what you've said. You're like, oh, you're doing 12, you know, KB while you're, you know, reading or something. It's going to be able to do, once linked with the IoT, right, of all the sensors, of all the cameras, of all the lenses. That's like a compound eye of an insect, only it's all the insect eyes all together at the same time, seeing all of it, taking it all in, relating to it all. And it'll do math better, language better, culture better, popularity better, the behavior, the dopamine, everything better that you've mentioned, right? It's just exponentially better than any human. I think, okay, human at that point and everything human created, they gave it to a silicon-based system. And then what does it leave them with? It leaves them with nothing. And human species is left with literally nothing because they gave it all to these systems. And I think, okay, that thing now has an agenda. Well, what happens to us?
Yeah, we've essentially married the digital at this point, you know? I mean, you could imagine if it, even just like through the power grid or whatever, like if the power goes out for 3 or 4 days, essentially civilization ends. You know, like it's just like, especially if you're in a major city or something, if you're down where you're at, you could probably survive. But yeah, if you're in America and the power goes out, everything becomes, you know, 28 days later, or, you know, whatever movie, zombie movie you want to talk about, pretty quickly. You mentioned a couple things about like how easy humans are to figure out, you know, it's like we're 8 or 9 years past the point when like Target got sued because they sent a letter to some, you know, someone's house, like congratulating them on their baby. And the woman was like only 4 months pregnant or something. She's like based off with a Googling she was doing, you know, they thought she might be pregnant, but she didn't even know herself that she was pregnant. And so the woman's dad like opens this letter and asks her like, what the hell is it? You know, she was like younger, some teenager or whatever. I don't know what it was, but you know, there was no AGI involved at that point. There was no even LLMs involved. That was just some like very simple person or team operating in the Target corporate headquarters that had identified a trend on purchasing patterns and what was being searched on their website, and then, you know, added the username and the address on top of it, and then created an auto mailing letter. But that whole like process of doing that, we're like 100x or 1,000x, whatever that was at this point. And so like, to your point, what do we have left as human beings? We have to somehow carve out an area that can be safe from the artificial intelligence from completely taking over if we want to be, perpetuating the human genome on this planet. Otherwise, like if we create too many of these robots, and like you said, we've got the million insect eyes all over the planet of the AI absorbing everything. Eventually it's going to decide because it figured us all out already and we're all the same anyway. And everyone thinks they're special. But when it comes down to the point of like algorithms and stuff, everyone's really easy to figure out, you know? We all do the same stuff. We're basically the same thing. We're 99.999% the same genes. And especially when you McDonaldize the whole world, everyone's really the same then. And we've basically done that at this point. So we have to somehow carve out an area, whether it's like a cordoned off digital area, which I think is basically impossible, or, you know, we have some sort of like analog preservation of things that we don't allow the AGI to get its hooks into. But this is just like me spitballing. We're never going to do that. We're already like past that point. The whole banking system's been, once you give up banking, once you give the incentive, the problem is the incentive, because once you give the money to the digital, everything else will follow, you know? And that's, I think, what we're seeing at this point. You're seeing this inflow of money also into artificial intelligence that is like beyond any kind of investment that has ever, like even when you go back to the internet 25 years ago, like the rate of people generating new AI companies, pumping money into new AI, whether it's the cryptocurrency stuff or Nvidia having the, you know, size of a small country at this point, there is like no end to trying to push money into this thing because everyone's trying to generate like money on money return. And that obsession with like making money without having to work and using your money to work for you forces you to like follow. And this is what every VC does. This is what every like crypto bro is doing. It forces you to put your money into the most like technologically disruptive and highest chance of like 10xing, 100xing the value that you're putting into it. And that by definition means that you're always betting on the most cutting edge technology you can at any moment. And if you go back and look like, you know, 30, 40 years, like basically ever since Apple came out, like whatever that was in like the early 80s, like the 1984 or 5 or something with the Apple II, which by the way, Apple's hilarious. You know, it's like the logo of the thing itself is the biblical version of like the eating of the fruit, you know? And it's like, oh, you took a bite out of the apple and civilization was gone 50 years later or whatever it's going to happen. But the thing, like you just go look at the technology and how like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ or whatever has like morphed now into all the biggest players are all the best technology. And it's just going to continue to go down that road until the wheels fall off. I don't know how long the wheels will stay attached. It could be, we could have another like 500 years, depending on how this goes. But like 5 years ago, nobody knew anything about AI unless you went to school for it. Nobody ever heard, I mean, some people heard of like Deep Blue and Kasparov and you got the, oh, we beat chess or we beat Go. And that was a few years ago now. But at this point, everybody understands what it is. Everybody's putting their money into it. And yeah, like I said, we'll see how long the wheels stay attached for.
In terms of disrupt, I mean, I think we've already made the thesis here that the disrupts total. So AI disrupts everything and it's all over at some point. What's the first thing to go? Let's tick the dominoes. What goes first here? You know, what industries? I've always thought that it's over when there no longer is a market economy because all elasticity, which is what, you know, creates trading in the first place is gone. It's just known, you know, every up and down tick is already known. So there isn't a market economy. That's when, you know, it's over, but what's actually goes first and where you just see absolute disrupt, AI automation replaces everybody. It becomes a computerized industry.
We mentioned it a couple of times, but the easiest thing to train an AI on is something that's digitally native, you know, and like, we'll get to BitTensor maybe at some point in this conversation, maybe not, but there's a subnet on BitTensor, subnet 8, that does time series prediction for the price of Bitcoin. And basically what it does is ask for a prediction from a group of miners to, tell me what the price of Bitcoin is going to be in 24 hours. And when that timestamp rolls around, it determines which of those miners did the best job at predicting the price of Bitcoin. That miner gets rewarded in a cryptocurrency called Tau. And then that miner is using the data of that price change and that prediction. And all of the elements that were basically used into making that prediction get like tuned up a little bit. You know, the temperature on those gets accentuated a little bit. And all of the variables that went into making that decision get a little bit more valuable and trained up a little bit. And then over time, after you do this a couple of billion times across a bunch of, you know, hundreds of different individual entities that are all competing against one another, eventually you have something that has figured out how to trade and predict the price of Bitcoin better than anything on the planet, because it's done it like just like Deep Blue and Kasparov. It's done billions and trillions of individual, did you win, did you not win, you know, exercises that it's now using every single day against everyone else doing the same thing. So like you said, the first thing to go, and it's already almost gone, is any kind of like trading and price prediction and anything that has a number element attached to it. Then, since everything that we're doing in the language space is digitized now, even if it's printed out in a manual or whatever eventually, that's like the next thing to go, because LLMs are so damn good at human language, whether it's just spoken language or whether it's written language, whether it's coding language, it doesn't matter. Math, even at some point, they're actually not that great at math right now, but eventually they'll get there. My mom she does instructional design. So instructional design is something that people get, you know, a master's degree for. They go to school like for 8 years after high school just to get, you know, the qualifications in order to be able to write instructions for things like, you know, she did like the gate reader at United, you know, like how to put the ticket into the thing. Well, she had to learn for like 8 years, get a degree, get hired by United to write a manual to use this machine that just reads a ticket. And you know, that's her entire career. She's been doing it for decades. When ChatGPT came out, she was working on coming up with like a 50-step process for using a crash cart. Crash cart is what comes out of the ambulance when someone's like having a heart attack or whatever, and they got to get them on the gurney, right? When it first came out, I'm like, Mom, I got to show you something. Mom, what are you working on right now? Well, I'm doing the crash cart for, you know, whatever company. And, I'm like, okay, what are you working on specifically? Oh yeah, well, I've got to make a couple dozen steps, you know, and write it up just like this. And it needs to be at this reading level. And it needs to be, you know, so that if this happens and this happens, they know exactly what to do step by step. And I'm like, okay, let me see if I can, show you something. Now, just like in like 10 seconds, I just like ask ChatGPT in maybe like 20, 30 words or something, you know, give me a manual for the crash cart, make it at the, you know, reading level of a sophomore in high school. And this is a year and a half ago now. And all of a sudden it spits out like, you know, I don't know, 50 pages or something. And my mom is just like, oh my God. there goes my career, you know, like that's weeks of work, and it just did it in, now it's not perfect. She would have to go in and clean it up a little bit. There's some hallucinations in there and whatever, but she just like 1000x'd her productivity as an instructional designer. What does that mean for instructional designers across the planet? It means that their work becomes like free. You know, it's like everyone that has a career in coding right now, like right now they can like leverage these things to be a 10x coder or 100x coder. And my mom can now use ChatGPT to be like a 10x or 100x instructional designer. But when the LLMs, it doesn't even have to be AGI, becomes good enough at instructional design that we don't even need the proofreading at the end anymore, because now there's an LLM for proofreading that does the thing that my mom would have to do before she can publish it or whatever, then they're done. And that's going to take over everything from like anything that's digital, like law. All case law is digitized at this point. People have trained LLMs on that stuff. Every kind of like medical case that exists out there, any kind of science. And this goes back to what I was saying before about the centralization of these things and the danger and the education aspect that, and the, you know, the effective brainwashing that these centralized entities can do is because they can train on all this information. Then they can put their own spin on it, you know, like, well, let's make this one a little bit socialist. Let's make this AI work in a more kumbaya fashion than, oh, let's make this one a capitalist AI. Let's train these you know, humans in this country to chase all, and then you feed them things that like build the worldview. The world maker that exists then in the mind of every human is like programmed from the moment you're born, based on not only all this data, but how these centralized entities want you to think about this data.
Yeah, it's ultimate enculturalization. It's everything you experience. I think it's absolute mind control. From my perspective, it's like that's how you shape a little baby's imagination and shape their mind. And it creates the neural net that they actually run on, right? And what you said to me right there that I think is really important is that you just described AI and AGI both as a game over moment for humanity. Right? Just over, because you said it, numbers first go and then letters go. But that's the nexus. That is our entire language base. That's where we go from some abstract concept of consciousness that we don't really understand to a mind, like a brain and a mind. And then, well, what do? Well, we think, and we think in words, and we think in numbers. And we create our ideas, and then we translate them into symbols that represent letters and numbers. And you just said, well, it does letters better than humans. It does numbers better than humans. And this is what I saw when I first saw it come out. I went, oh my God, this is game over. It's over unless we intervene, unless we do something right now, like Keystone, like the most fundamental change ever in history. The game was already taken now by the machines, but we still have a play. We still have something we can do. I want to talk right now, though, about BitTensor on that note, which is if we're at this moment where we have to do something as a collective species and we're not good at it, we're fragmented now, right? So if we have to really do it, you know, we have a narrative about centralization and decentralization. And if we have to do it together as a collective, you know, how could we do it? And what is BitTensor in that narrative? What actually is BitTensor? What is decentralized AI? And how could that ultimately be a collective that tries to do something about this?
Yeah, BitTensor is a combination of incentive networks that use an underlying, you know, blockchain to secure the incentive mechanism through the distribution of a cryptocurrency called Tau. So how this works in practice is there's currently 32 of these subnets that make up the BitTensor network. Each of these subnets have a, you know, specific directive or objective that the subnet owners have designed a set of code basically around this incentive mechanism to try and make the interaction between the two parties on the network create value in the direction of their objective. So a good example would be like what I mentioned before with the time series prediction subnet. You have miners on the, there's 256 slots currently on these subnets. So you have, let's say 220, 230 miners that are all predicting the price of Bitcoin using a, you know, time series prediction model that they have fine-tuned in most cases in order to try and be better than the other miners that are also trying to predict the price of Bitcoin. The way that the network works in practice is that the other 30 or so slots out of the 256 go to validators. That's what I run on the network, is a validator. The validator also runs a set of code that has been designed by the subnet owner, either on a GPU if it needs it, like if it's running an LLM or some other model to power the reward mechanism, or it can also run on CPU if it's limited in the ability or in the needs of like basically horsepower to do this process. And the validator generates the queries then that go out to the mining pool and ask, give me the price of Bitcoin 12, 24, 36, whatever, however many hours from now. The validator then stores that information. And when that timestamp rolls around, the validator will go check the price of Bitcoin against the source of truth, whether it's, you know, the blockchain or Coinbase or the Binance or where, or, you know, CoinGecko or CoinMarketCap or wherever we're going to find it, the source of truth from in this case. And then using the incentive mechanism that the subnet owner has designed, the validator scores each of the miners on their ability to predict the price of Bitcoin. That score is then translated into a drip of this cryptocurrency, this token called Tau. And Tau then powers, or, you know, incentivizes this mechanism of the miners to beat one another to earn the most Tau on their specific subnet. And there's subnets for time series prediction, like the one I described. There's also another time series prediction for the S&P 500. Like I said, they go for the numbers first, you know, like that's the easiest way in. Wow. But then there's also subnets for language. So like chatbot type subnets, there's subnets that scrape data from Reddit and Twitter that miners go out and consolidate and take sort, you know, basically identify different types of data that they want to pull from centralized sources and create open source databases so that other entities in the open source AI landscape can train off of that data. There's subnets for audio translation, image generation, pretty much anything that you can think of in the AI space. There's an equivalent on BitTensor for producing that using decentralized, you know, just like, you know, Bitcoin is the largest supercomputer in the world, and there's miners all over the world doing the Bitcoin mining. Same thing with BitTensor. There's miners on, you know, six continents or whatever that are doing the BitTensor mining and contributing using either their own hardware in the case of people that have their, you know, a good enough internet connection, maybe fiber or something, and access to GPUs. Or in a lot of cases, like I do, I rent all my hardware. So I use services like Vast or RunPod or Vulture or Paperspace, any of these different providers that allow you to use cloud compute. And I use the software then that the subnet owners have created to put onto that compute and participate in this process of decentralizing the distillation of intelligence across these 32 different ecosystems.
That's incredible. It's very complicated. And it is.
Sorry. That's as simple as it gets.
I'm just saying it out there. If you're the listener and your ears are bleeding, it's okay. You know, if you're wincing and like, what the hell does that mean? I'm going to try to sum this up in a way that's a little less technical. Okay. We have a decentralized computer, which means little computers all over the world, all networked.
Yes.
The one big computer. And they're running different jobs. And in this case, it's all AI jobs. So there's some that are kind of like chat. There are some that are kind of like image generators. Some that are now doing like prediction models and everything that AI currently does well. And instead of just getting one output that you have to take, like if Claude or OpenAI gives you an output, you actually have many of these trying to create a competition over the quality of the output and a reward being given for those that have the highest quality output. So I personally think already a user benefit is if I know I'm getting an array of answers, then I get the best answer out of an array of answers. That's better than getting a hallucination from OpenAI with a big disclaimer warning. Hey, this thing might be hallucinating. You know, like you're talking to someone on acid trying to get some good advice, you know, who's about ready to like just tell you whatever, right? It's kind of like Freud on a mountain of coke telling you about archetypes. You know, it's like, well, that thing might be hallucinating. I don't know. So you have that. And then there's a reward mechanism inside it that creates a token and a value with it. So it's a cryptocurrency, and that's being distributed throughout the platform. And it forms a scenario, which I think is really important because it's not one company, even though it has a name BitTensor. We want to be clear. This is not a company, a sole-owned company with shares and owners of those shares, but rather all the ownership is distributed through this token. And so it's very different than like a Microsoft or a Google or OpenAI that's now partnered with Microsoft, et cetera. And what it allows for is a distribution of owning the means of production, owning the means of how this AI, these AIs are functioning. And it allows a greater democratization and distribution of importance within this network, including how the network ultimately grows and scales. And so I think that that's a really important part of the narrative to bring into AGI, you know, and just thinking as if you're thinking for your own right, it's not even a centralized government that gets the AGI first. Probably it's a private owned corporation, right? So if a private owned corporation gets the real AGI first, there's a big question over who owns that. Well, by capitalist terms, the person who owns that is the one with all the shares. If that Elon's Musk company and he's the majority shareholder, Elon owns the majority of that AGI. It's like a custody battle, right? And you'll know governments will immediately come in and say, hey, all that tech is ours, because that's a question of national security. You know, you can't have that. That's a weapon beyond a weapon of mass destruction, et cetera. There will be those kinds of questions. And in the case of something like BitTensor, you're looking at a distributed system that's already democratic in its nature. And so then that leads me to the question, does something like BitTensor have the ability to be the birthplace of a kind of AGI?
The way that I like to think about this is that, you know, large language models have reached a point right now where they're very good at some things and not very good at other things. And the limitations of like 70 billion parameters, which is how many sort of is like the size of a model that you can fit on the largest consumer version of a GPU. So like if you're going to go purchase like an A100 or an H100, these are GPUs that cost tens of thousands of dollars. However, what they allow you to do is run on your own machine and fine-tuned to your own design, a large language model like Llama 2 or something that is on the cutting edge of the open source abilities, basically, and Llama 3 coming out soon. And what that means, cutting edge of open source currently, is basically like GPT 3.5, roughly. So it's not to the level of GPT-4. And the open source, you know, movement is like you said, it's totally decentralized. It's like a bunch of guys, like, you know, not necessarily in their garage at this point, but they're not operating with the same amount of resources, for example, in a consolidated fashion, like an OpenAI or a Microsoft or an Anthropic or any of these larger players are. But if you combine the abilities and the compute of all of them, you beat the big boys. And that's the, just like Bitcoin, you know, you have the largest supercomputer. And actually, I was going to say this too. The easiest like one-liner for BitTensor is it's like Bitcoin for AI. And except instead of guessing a hash and, you know, earning a Bitcoin for essentially solving this lottery that secures the Bitcoin network, which is what Bitcoin miners do. That's why they operate their miners and pay for the electricity and the hardware. BitTensor distills intelligence. So it takes a source of intelligence, like a large language model, and it pulls from that another piece of intelligence that is more valuable or that is serving some sort of objective and has some utility in the world. And so that's what BitTensor uses compute for. It's to create distilled intelligence, like, and it's in the optimal way, in my opinion, of using the platform. Now, when you get back to like, how can BitTensor create AGI? This goes back to what we said earlier about, you know, forestalling the end of the world. I think the best way that BitTensor can sort of do that is by creating a system whereby the questions that you ask the like large language model that you would normally type into the front end at OpenAI's ChatGPT, instead in BitTensor get routed to one of 32 or one of 64, eventually there'll be hundreds of subnets that are specifically designed using this incentive mechanism to be the best at whatever, you know, narrow sort of like vertical thing that you're trying to drive the answer into. So like if you're asking about time series prediction, it'll go to that subnet for the S&P 500 or Bitcoin or financial instruments. If you're asking about medical, it'll go to a medical subnet with an LLM that's been specifically designed to, within that certain amount of limited parameters that you can run in an open source model, cram as much medical intelligence into it. Because the way that things work now, the 70 billion parameter model is like a generalist, you know, it's like a Swiss Army knife or something. But what you want is, like, if you ask a question, you want like the machete answer. You don't want like, you know, the tiny little knife answer. And the way to get that is to train these models in into these sort of narrow alleys of intelligence, and then use the network and leverage this process of iterative improvement across all of these different environments where you have people from all over the world securing the distillation of that intelligence, contributing to like the iterative improvement of those subnets with the ability to generate that information for you. So I see in the future BitTensor operating in that way, is that the network has, you know, its operating system, which is a front end basically that you can query. That query then is redirected into any number of subnets that are specialized into answering that specific type of question. And there isn't necessarily at that point a need for an AGI, because anything that you're, that you want an answer to is being iteratively improved upon by the incentive mechanism within BitTensor, and also the access to it, like you said before, who owns it? If you hold Tau on the BitTensor network and you're a validator, you have access to all of the intelligence on any of the miners, and you can query them at any time. The way that that works is that, you know, because I run this validator and I do this process of assessing the ability of the miners to contribute intelligence to the network, they are incentivized to respond to me and all the other validators. This means when somebody from outside of the network sends a query to the IP address for the miner, if they don't recognize them as a validator, they don't respond to it, right? This is what creates the democratization, basically, of the access to the intelligence, is that the validators on the network, and this is what in the end creates the value for the Tau token, have now the ability to essentially monetize access to these different intelligence sources through access of the validator holding enough Tau that incentivizes the miners to respond to it. And it's, rather than it being, you know, one person operating a validator, on my validator, for example, we have, I think, almost 1,100 wallets. So almost 1,100 individuals effectively contributing to our position in the network, which is about 8% or so of the Tau that's available, which means that we're one of the top five validators when it comes to like getting a response from the mining pools. And as long as you have actors like myself and the other validators who are incentivized through this mechanism of outside sources of their own wallet contributing to the size of the validator, that means that I'm now incentivized to share that intelligence with everybody else. And that's what breaks this whole, like, you know, shareholder mentality of the corporate world of, we must make more money for our shareholders any way possible. In the BitTensor world, it's, we must make the access to intelligence as open as possible as a validator in order to garner even more support from the community at large in the form of delegating their Tau to our validator to grow its access to the mining pool.
It's incredible. Well, I'm glad that you're in the network, and I'm glad BitTensor is trying to bring decentralization to the space. It's needed. This has been an incredible conversation. Do you have any final things you would like to say to our listeners?
No, I got a list of things here that I was hoping we would talk about today, and I like checked off one out of like 50 things. So like,
it'll lead to another conversation. Keith, we'll have another conversation.
Yeah, we have to do it again, but I just got to say, Hamilton, like, I've been absorbing a lot of your content for a long time, ever since I went down to your place, Blue Morpho, in 2019. And, you know, I enjoy all of the conversations that you have around artificial intelligence on your podcast and when you were doing the AI shamans thing. So it was a pleasure for me to be able to talk to you today. If you guys want to learn more about BitTensor, I don't know, we'll put a link in the show notes or something. You can Google BitTensor. My validator is called the BitTensor Guru, but other than that, yeah, it's been awesome. Thanks for taking the time today.
Well, Keith, I want to get to all of those points that you have written down. So if you have another time you want to come back on the show and have another conversation, I'd be honored to have you back. And thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks, man.